Good morning. I'm here with Dr. Shapley, an associate professor in anesthesia, and we are interested in discussing basic research careers from the perspective of a mentor-mentee and what actually drove him to decide upon being a career basic researcher, in addition to having a very busy clinical practice. So, welcome. It's good to have you.
Yeah, thank you, Dr. Thank you for the invitation.
So what I'd like to get into is really some questions about from the get-go, what drove you to have an interest in working in a lab or being a basic researcher?
Yeah, I think interestingly, so part of my role is as a clinician in the ICU and the operating room. And my initial forays into research were around clinical questions. And I think for all of us, I think it's right. What are we exposed to? I think there was a real evolution of my thinking, and a lot of my work centers around oxygen therapy and gastrotransmitters. And so I ended up doing a small clinical trial here at the BI, which was, very, which I learned a great deal from. One of the things from that is it was a negative result, despite being clinically quite intuitive. And I realized, at least for me, the thought of being a serial clinical trialist, taking certain interventions and not mechanistically understanding exactly the underpinnings of what's maybe driving some of these results, was problematic. And so, despite not having a formal background and training in basic research, I came to the lab here and started exploring some of those questions around oxygen titration in more basic models. And I think that's really added a lot to the entire portfolio of my research.
So if you were to be in a position to advise someone, if you take yourself back 3 or 4 years and advise someone who was in your shoes then, because now you've been in it, how would you advise them from or give them guidance if they chose to have the idea that they wanted to become a basic researcher? What have been some challenges and some successes, if you will, along the path for you? What would you tell that young faculty who's looking to have a basic research career?
Yeah, I think research in general, the two ingredients that are completely requisite to even consider success are time and mentorship. And I think initially I probably got relatively bogged down in the scientific question, rather than thinking about the scientific process. And I think if you think about both, engagement, in terms of what you would, what's going to keep you sustained. And also candidly, and we have to think about transaction, at least grant funding, the science, especially at the early stage, is really not what's driving things. And the scientific contribution in an early stage, again, at the beginnings of one's career, is modest and incremental. And so to really focus on scientific contribution, and I think is probably a little bit of I wouldn't say wasted effort, but I do think that that shouldn't be a central theme as one starts out. I think the environment you're in, and if you think about right career development awards at the NIH or foundational awards, there are essentially four key areas that are equally weighted. Environment is one, mentorship is another, the candidate is the third, and the science is the fourth. And I would maybe even put them in that order. So thinking about the evolution of what you want your research to look like, I think you need that time and you need that mentorship and finding a mentor, and even thinking more and more about mentorship models these days is important. And I think the science can change and should change based on right, the work you're doing. So I think I think having said that, having a body of work or an area that you're interested in is obviously key, but having the malleability and flexibility to follow the results is equally important.
So building on that idea, which I think is great insight, is if you have a KO8 as you do, which is admirable for someone who has such a busy clinical schedule, how would you advise someone, because you actually chose to pursue a mentor outside of your own department, how would you advise a junior faculty in anesthesia per se, for instance, in finding a mentor in an area, let's say they have an interest in, let's say they're interested in oxygen as yourself, how would you say to them, and how would you advise them? I keep coming back to that because I think it's important. Where should I go to find a mentor, and what should I be looking for in a mentor to meet the goals that I'm looking for?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think, finding mentors in departments of any size is a really interesting question, and I would say there's sort of a few things that are important. I think you always go, even if you have successful mentors within your department. We're at Harvard, and we have, the CTSA under the Harvard Catalyst is a great resource. Looking around the institution is key. So I certainly looked outside of my department, and even I have, other mentors within the department, but even the concept of looking outside is much more fruitful than is much more fruitful overall than just sort of having a less broad horizon. And I would also say that the concept of sort of radical innovation, and I think we've talked about this as a group before, I come with some clinical ideas. My basic knowledge at the beginning of my case certainly was very rudimentary. And so, but it's, it's understanding clinical process. Everyone brings something to the table. And so going outside of your department really brings in that key collaboration that is synergistic in terms of research.
And do you find that the protected time that the KO8 has allowed you to have, or is dictated by the KO8, is well received from your superiors, in this case your division chiefs or your department chairs? Is it a realistic approach and a mechanism, if you will, that the NIH puts out to say that a KO8 will give you the necessary time, or is there really it really become challenging when you're trying to meld that with your clinical duties? Is it realistic?
I think it's a great question. I think certain subspecialties clinically really lend themselves to a setup of a career development award, others less so. If you think about anesthesia, let's say surgery, these are clinically very busy environments, not that others aren't, that are interventionally based, and there is a real commitment to spending that time clinically to maintain your skill set. There's also a revenue generation on the clinical side that can somewhat be in antagonism with an open schedule when it comes to really thinking about science and developing through the K. I would say that I was fortunate enough to receive great support, but it's a two-sided coin, and going to your chair or division chief and saying, right, this is what the return on investment will look like, this is what I'm doing. And it's the same thing with your mentor or mentee relationships, as opposed to, let's say, your chair relationship and broadcasting sort of where you're going with it, where's your science going, what are the grants you're applying for, what are the papers that are coming out, what are the areas that you're interested in, what are the collaborations, so that people understand that there is always going to be a return on investment. And so it's not a question of I've got my time and I'm in the lab for 4 days a week, let's say, and I go and do my work clinically. And also then there's a question of building your research career while sustaining your clinical one. And that's a slightly separate topic, but we can delve into as well. And there's also a minimization of risk aspect, because you're really committing to a pathway where other colleagues are committing clinically. So one has to balance all of those things. But I think, clearly defining those expectations with your chair and your mentor is key. And having that structure and giving people timelines to show that investment is being realized, is also key. And also open and honest communication. I think, again, finding facilitators, division chiefs and chairs will understand certain things, but maybe some of them are more clinical. I'm in the Department of Anesthesia. Our chair is a internationally renowned clinical trialist, and doesn't necessarily have the same, boots on the ground understanding of basic research. He certainly supports it very well, but the nuts and bolts of that are slightly different. So, I think constant communication and honest communication, I think, is a big part of that, both obviously with your mentor or mentors, and your chair.
If you you mentioned about mentoring, and I think that's a key component to what we're trying to understand with junior faculty, and particularly those who are interested in the investigative track. Would you say that, in your opinion, that it would be better to have multiple mentors, meaning a team approach, or do you think a one-on-one is a more efficient, more effective way to help your career development? And then and touching upon all aspects, right? There's the grant achieving mechanisms, there's the promotion track, there's retention, of course. What would be your view of mentoring? Again, coming back to this idea that what is the view in terms of most effective way to achieve your goals? Because if you've got to spend time in the clinic on the West Campus, because we're here at the Beth Israel Deaconess, on the East Campus, where most of the basic research is done, it seems to me that having a mentoring team may be a better approach. I'm not sure, but it's certainly something to think about. And would you say that there's a need to have, in your case, a clinical mentor and a basic mentor, or can one person suffice? And would they be better at that task, having a single person versus a group? And when you bring in things like group, you know, that obviously has dynamics that have to be dealt with in terms of one person's opinion versus another, versus who do you pay attention to versus who do you give less attention to in terms of comments and feedback. So from a mentoring standpoint, again, trying to provide information to those who are entering this area of wanting to have a career, and you were standing now years out, what would be your viewpoint from above now that you can look back and say, this was what I felt was helpful, this is what I didn't feel was helpful, and I'm looking for your candidness. I mean, this is really to help others who are listening to say, if you want to approach a research investigative track as a clinical physician scientist, what would you tell that junior person?
Yeah,
you know, in terms of their next
steps? No, it's a great question, and there's a lot to unpack there. I would say, I would still say, right, it takes a village overall. So I think the organic process of developing friendships, collaborations, you know, peer mentoring, and obviously a traditional one-on-one mentorship model, all of those things really go into the mix. I think, you know, the ability for everyone to understand, obviously, the science, you know, the grant writing process, but the rest of, you know, one's, you know, professional obligations, whether that be in the clinics, whether that be in the lab, I think is important. I think so the benefits of the traditional one-on-one mentorship model are, obvious. They're widely used in academic medicine. So the benefits would really be the sort of, you know, tailored advice, personalized attention. It's a huge undertaking as I mentor people myself more and more and enjoy that. But, you know, that is to do that well properly is you know, you know, not benign and quite consuming for both sides. So there's an ability to develop that close relationship with a senior colleague, but there's also not that many people who mentor well and both, you know, there scientifically, administratively, and have the ability to give that time. So choosing your mentor, obviously, in a one-on-one mentorship model is key. And then there are some limitations, right? There's potential for bias. As we said, there's limited availability. There may be more diverse perspectives that can be gleaned from a team model. There's also changing dynamics, right? Within a mentor-mentee model. At the beginning, I think it really is quite traditional and maybe, depending on the relationship and the tone, somewhat hierarchical. But as you move forward, does that meander well into collaboration? You know, the separation of ideas, all of those things have to be navigated, you know, but other models exist, team-based mentoring models. I think, and again, I don't want to, it's not really a buzzword around things, but I do think that, you know, we're looking at more distant mentorship models as well, right? So we're now in a virtual environment and you can, you know, sure, there's no substitute for an open door policy for your mentor just down the hall. But there is, you know, something to be said for an international leader in you know, an aligned space, you know, who may be a couple of time zones away, but will happily meet once a quarter or a couple of times a year to give you advice. So I would look at it as not mutually exclusive. And I think one has to be strategic, but authentic about mentorship choices and models.
So let me ask you a separate but related question, which is, like, Ben, back to some of the research and your experiences in a basic research environment. Do you need a PhD in order to succeed? Do you need formal training coming from a clinical training background and adventuring into the world of wet bench research and animal models and things like that? Do you think you are at a disadvantage or not? It doesn't really matter that you can be a successful researcher without, again, I'm just speaking to the research, the basic research side, because PhD offers you some things and you may come into a world where you don't need a PhD necessarily to be successful. But in your experience, I always bring it back to what you've, again, offered to those who are listening. And someone who says, I don't have a PhD, I've never really worked in the lab, there's no place for me there, I will never be successful. Do you think that having been in the lab now and been around it, this sort of world, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, I think it's a great question. I would say yes and no. I would say sometimes formal training is absolutely essential. But in this case, it's not. But there are many other requisites that for you to even consider succeeding or competing, within a purely basic environment as a clinician, you really have to take on board. And we've gone back to this mentorship and the ability to learn a lot of those skills is there. I mean, a PhD can be a very narrow, area of investigation for someone, and the skill set can be deep, but not necessarily broad. So there's certainly that aspect of things. The scientific process that comes along with that, the understanding of basic methods that comes along with that, those are things that can certainly be learned. It's also quite difficult for people to go back, as a clinician, obviously, to then formally come into a PhD role. So I would say that, you have to navigate around that. One is rarely going to be able to go back and acquire that in a formal way. But, you have to accept that there are a lot more better, a lot more well-trained people around you with a lot of expertise. They're very, I still am very optimistic and grateful for the level of collaboration that you see in the culture of basic science, certainly at the BI. And I think that's not unique to the BI. So if you want to do something, it's like lessons in life. If you really want to do it, then you sort of have to roll up your sleeves. And I think people respond very well to that. So I will say that the culture clinically of maybe a little bit of degree of hierarchy, a higher level of delegation, that is not going to work in basics. You really have to understand the process. You have to be doing those, experiments yourself, at least at the beginning. You have to be able to troubleshoot experiments. You have to gain that validity. There's an internal and external validity of which, obviously, you have to feel comfortable doing those things yourselves, but people will pass judgment and say, is this guy a bona fide scientist, on the basic side? So a PhD is not needed, but the skills that are derived from what a PhD gives people by proxy are absolutely essential.
These are great, great insights. If you were to look, since you've got a lot of experience with, as you mentioned, some of the other affiliates, is it fair to try and make some comparisons with how you've seen, or maybe you have or haven't seen, how their programs are functioning? Meaning, in your experience, or maybe, like I said, you've heard, are the KO8s and the training grants and the physician scientists given the same amount of mentoring, or are there programs you've seen or instances that you've experienced where you find that the BI may explore new avenues to facilitate this? Meaning, if you were to look at how the Brigham Women's or the Mass General or any of the others have their physician scientists going through their own training, are there things here that you would look to say could be improved, or you would tout as being different enough that's a success? Is there any, and maybe you haven't, so it's just a question.
Yeah, no, I think, and there, I have some ideas in general around that. So I think we do a good job overall, but I think the departments still remain relatively siloed, and it's up to each department to have their own viewpoint on the importance of K's, you know, on the investability of you know, career development awards, on what happens clinically to those folks. So I would be, you know, we've got a couple of great examples of really cohesive strategies across, you know, across the departments. And so the GRASP initiative is certainly one. And that sort of really gives people project management and task management around lots of aspects of running a lab and building, you know, towards independence and that K to R conversion. I think that's probably where the crux is. I think in the present environment, you know, I think a talented clinician with a good mentor, you know, in this environment has a very competitive chance of getting K. To convert that to an R is a different story. And I think that's a metric that we have to probably, as we are, but I think that's what we should look at. I think there is opportunity for a more centralized way of looking at all of this. I think there could be, you know, perhaps more horizontally structured seminars and overall sort of, you know, programs to bring everyone together. I think what the BI is really has done well over the last few years, but wasn't the case maybe historically, is really bringing, you know, this cross-departmental and cross-specialty collaboration together. And I also think the academic and industry relationship is also relatively, I think, is growing in maturity, you know, here from BI. So, and I would say that's probably in contrast to some of our sister institutions in the city. So I think, you know, having access to sort of industry ideas or funding or collaboration, I think, is key. And I think building horizontal structures rather than staying siloed vertically is something that we've embarked on, and there's more work to be done.
Excellent. And a fun final set of questions. What does the future hold for you? If you had to, as we always hear, what does your next 5 years or 10 years look like? What would be a success story for yourself, coming from someone who entered the lab not long ago, 3 or 4 years ago, is now at the point where the mechanism for NIH is to transition to R's? What would be your perfect view for the next 5 years or even beyond for that matter? And I'd like to speak to where you would like to be clinically and where you would like to be as an investigator as a principal investigator in a research environment.
Yeah. So, and I think going, and this sort of ties in with the previous point around, is a PhD necessary? And I think the follow-on question from that is, as a clinician scientist, can you compete with PhDs in the basic environment? And I think the reason I bring that up is, and not that, you know, the PhD path is, you know, more linear, but I would say someone like myself probably has 3 or 4 different arenas that, you know, I'm looking to develop. And so that's clinically, administratively, you know, maybe research outside of the basic setting, and also basic research. And so, and I can take a little bit of a dive on all of those. So clinically, you know, my practice is where I'd want it to be. And I think maintaining that in the setting of a you know, a good size and ideally increasing research footprint is a challenge. And that needs to be, you know, navigated with the same deliberation that one's basic research is. And so I would like to continue my time in the cardiac operating rooms as well as the ICUs. And I think that would be fine. Administratively, you know, one of the things that comes along with, you know, research success is obviously incremental, you know, administrative load. And that is both a gift and a curse, candidly. And so one really has to be very deliberate around that. And that's where a mentor and your own philosophies around your work-life balance, you know, come into play. And so I've taken on various administrative roles in the Department of Anesthesia and sit at the vice chair level currently. And so I really enjoy that. But I know that, and I put my hand up and say there are compromises that have to be made because of all of that. And you know, we know we can't do everything all of the time, and that's just the bottom line. And so, you know, there's a dilution and there's also a pivot over time. You know, not everything is fixed. You know, I've spent more time over research over the last 4 or 5 years. I'll probably spend a little bit less with maybe a little bit of a more organized and formal infrastructure to my research and me doing less hands-on work over the next 5 years. And that's sort of the natural progression. And that frees up other time for other things. You know, I think in my viewpoint, despite spending a good amount of time on the basic side, I think where I think where the value is really added is that clinical input and that understanding of what, you know, what are relevant clinical questions for our patients, and, you know, access to clinical samples, for example. And so that marriage, I think, is key. And I think probably over the next 5 years, that's going to be where I would say my success will be measured, is the ability to bring something more to the table. Because I regard myself at this point of being able to speak the language of basic science, but, you know, will I be industrious in that sense? Yes. I mean, I would like, in terms of the basic side, to certainly have R01 funding from, you know, from a basic source. And I think for me, that would be an excellent aim over the next 5 years. So, you know, it's much more holistic. And I think the Venn diagram for me, at least, is a series of circles overlapping in various different ways. But yes, I would say that the metric still stays the same, which is independent R1 funding at the basic level.
Excellent. Well, it's been wonderful to have you here today. I'm going to end with just you telling me what your official titles are, so I capture that correctly. You are...
Yeah, sure. Yeah. So for my sins, I'm an associate professor of anesthesia at Harvard Medical School. I'm the vice chair for professional affairs within the Department of Anesthesia, Critical Care and Pain Medicine. I co-direct the ECMO program for the hospital, and I'm affiliate member of the Broad Institute.
Excellent. Much praise for those achievements. He also has a family, and most of you will know him as Shaz. That's how I've gotten to know him, and he's a wonderful physician scientist. And I hope you have enjoyed this session on perspectives from an evolving physician scientist who has been fortunate to achieve a grant support, has made great progress, and we look forward to his successes in the future. And hopefully, he'll come back to join us to speak more about what his viewpoints are on how best to advise those who are interested in becoming physician scientists. So I'll sign off here, and thank you again for coming. I appreciate it.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.